Welcome. I'm Ethan Elkind, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. Later in the program, we're going to discuss a new New York Times investigation into the Trump family businesses and related conflicts of interest, including their affiliated crypto company, World Liberty Financial, which is profiting from Trump's presidency. According to the New York Times, World Liberty Financial has eviscerated the boundary between private enterprise and government policy in ways without precedent in modern American history. But first, we're going to look at the Doge Impact Tracker, a new project from the award-winning nonprofit publication Capital in Maine, which documents the real-life consequences of the Trump administration's so-called Department of Government Efficiency, or DOGE. Through original reporting and curated stories from across the country, the tracker shines a light on the toll these cuts are having. Marcus Baram, who is leading the DOGE Impact Tracker, is a longtime reporter and editor who has covered income inequality and the powerful influence of the oil and gas industry for Capital and Maine. And his critically acclaimed 2014 biography of the late Gil Scott Heron, Pieces of a Man, was named a notable book by The New Yorker. Thank you for joining us, Marcus.
Thank you for having me, Ethan. Really appreciate it.
So, Marcus, right after the inauguration, the so-called Department of Government Efficiency, or DOGE, basically became the playbook for Trump and Project 2025's bigger goal of gutting the federal government, shrinking the power of its branches, laying off the workforce. Now, there's been a lot of media attention on the tariffs recently in Washington, and I think less attention on just how deep these cuts from DOGE have really gone. So I wanted to just start by asking you if you can just talk a bit about how this whole DOGE project really began.
Well, it began really, I think, after Trump's election when they talked about it. And obviously Elon Musk, it was sort of his brainchild, and they kept tweeting about it. And obviously he named it after this meme coin that he's been boosting for, you know, over a year. And then it actually happened soon after the inauguration. They actually set it up as a semi-official part of the administration and started making their changes, focusing first on USAID.
And can you talk about some of the cuts that they've been essentially bragging about? And it's quite an expansive list that your tracker has been covering.
Yeah, I mean, the biggest one initially that got a lot of attention was USAID, the Agency for International Development, which they completely demolished. Like, that program is terminated. And that essentially provided a lot of humanitarian assistance to sub-Saharan Africa, to parts of Asia, everything from food aid that fed hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of people around the world, to malaria medications and other like antiviral drugs and people dealing with HIV. So provided a lot of incredible assistance. I mean, Bill Gates recently said that due to those cuts, the ending of USAID, literally millions of people will die.
I read that quote that he said, you know, there's something about the richest man in the world essentially killing some of the poorest children in the world. I'm wondering if you know, just thinking about the wide range of programs that are under attack here by DOGE, has anything really stood out to you, any key themes, anything that's really struck you about what agencies and what types of programs have been targeted?
I think what stood out to me, you know, Ethan, is that it's really impacted, it's across the government. I mean, I think the USAID got a lot of attention at the beginning, but then it really has impacted everything from the VA, so veterans' access to healthcare, groups like Catholic Charities, which help food banks, and a group called Feeding America, which literally fund hundreds, if not thousands, of food banks across the country. That has been majorly impacted. Healthcare, childcare, such as closing of Head Start offices, to farmers. A lot of farmers benefited from certain programs at the Department of Agriculture that reimbursed them for certain practices. Sustainable practices. And also there was a food for peace element to USAID, and it was sort of a win-win in which the US government would pay US farmers, American farmers, millions of dollars for crops that they would then give as humanitarian assistance. It was a wonderful program that I think goes back to the 50s, and that was demolished. So what struck me, I guess, was just the breadth of the of these cuts and the devastating impact they've had on all kinds of Americans, whether it's seniors, veterans, children, working families. So,
and Marcus, can you talk about some of those cuts that you highlight on your DOGE impact tracker on Capitol and Maine? Are there any, you know, really human toll type stories that you would like to highlight, or that really stood out to you?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, one of the big ones I think that was really interesting was its impact on a city. So there was a story about how Kansas City, the metropolitan area, had a lot of government workers. And so the layoffs of government workers through DOGE, through, you know, various government agencies that were based and had, you know, major workforces in Kansas City, was devastating to the city. I mean, literally, I can't recall the exact number, but it was a high percent of their workforce. And also, it just showed the extent of how it impacts a snapshot of one city out of many, by looking at the impacts on public health, environment, diversity programs, food aid, you know, programs that mainly help vulnerable people, poor people, working class people, people who are, you know, elderly, and need health care. So that was really impactful. And I think what really the genesis for this tracker was the idea that in the very beginning, and I think since it's been continuing that way over the last few months, a lot of the DOGE coverage is focused on sort of inside baseball, like what's happening in DC. And these are the internal battles happening with the agencies. Or they've been very bird's eye view looks at, oh, 10% of the Department of Education was axed. And I think the average American thinks, okay, is that a bad thing? You know, what does that mean? And there was very little coverage, except in a lot of local news sites and blogs and TV, local TV stations and radio, that focused on the actual human impacts, how it impacted people in their neighborhoods, in their communities.
I think that's that's such an interesting point, Marcus, just that the role of local news in covering this, and that you'd identified this kind of national gap. And it seems encouraging that local news has been able to at least document this. Can you talk just a bit more about the role of local news here and how it's, you know, how it's fared in trying to meet this moment of documenting these cuts?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I've been really struck how, I mean, there had been, you know, ABC News and the New York Times have done some coverage, but almost all of the reports that I pick up, and we've done over 50 at this point, have been mainly sourced from local news. Everything from, you know, the Minneapolis Star Tribune to the Tennessean, to even smaller local news blogs or nonprofits, the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, like these great local papers that have survived the decimation of local news and journalism in the last two decades and do good reporting on things happening in their community. And also, I have to say, TV stations, a lot of local TV stations in cities around the and communities around the country that have done good coverage.
Well, it's really remarkable. And since this is our media roundtable, it's nice to see just how critical the local news has been. Although, as you point out, these local news stations and outlets have really faced really dramatic cuts over the years, something we've documented certainly on this program, and others have as well. Now, some of the decisions and actions that DOGE have taken have been rescinded. Have you been following any of that? Have any of the programs that you initially were tracking, have they been reinstated? Can you talk about the status of some of the efforts to undo what DOGE is doing?
Yeah, I mean, some have. I think some of the funding freezes that happened in January, especially regarding food aid, were unfrozen, and that money went out. Although it still it was devastating to a lot of food banks because some of the cuts had already come through, or they were still kind of, you know, frozen. Others, like one thing I covered was the CFPB, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which you know, regulates consumer fraud, and that the administration pretty much tried to sort of decimate, do a USAID to that agency, and that's been in the courts. And from what I saw recently, I think yesterday or the day before, it looks like they have been ordered to basically reinstate most of the employees for the CFPB, and that will continue to run. I mean, so far it's been sort of a ghost website and a ghost operation, where they weren't really pursuing many investigations of banks and financial fraudsters. But it looks like they're going to bring back almost all the employees. And it remains to be seen because it's still kind of being, I think, fought in the courts.
Yes, it feels like a very fluid situation. So we're
Yeah.
speaking with Marcus Baram, who is leading the Doge Impact Tracker. This is covering the real-world nationwide impacts of the Doge, or Department of Government Efficiency, efforts to slash government spending, lay off federal workers. Marcus is a longtime reporter and editor covering income inequality and the powerful influence of the oil and gas industry, in particular for Capital and Maine. And I want to open up the phone lines now. If you have been affected by Doge cuts, we would love to hear from you. If you have thoughts about what Doge is doing and what could be done to try to stop some of these cuts, or what you think the opposition party should be doing to try to rein in what Doge is doing, you can join the conversation. We're at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255, or email your question or comment to yourcall@kalw.org. And Marcus, we've been talking about some of the setbacks to Doge in the court system. What about the possibility, or is it happening already, of political pushback, given that some of these cuts are happening in the districts of relatively powerful Congress members, including Republicans, and I would think creating some groundswell of public opposition to what Doge and the Trump administration is doing? Has that manifested itself?
I'm not, there have been obviously town halls that where videos went viral of, mainly Republican lawmakers being yelled at by community members, but I haven't seen too much. I mean, to be honest, I'm a little surprised because it is so pervasive. And in the words of, Steve Bannon, they really have flooded the zone with these cuts, and the impacts have been so, throughout the country. And I'm a little surprised that there hasn't been more pushback from whether local congressmen who represent those districts or from state senators and assembly people who would make a big fuss in their state capitals and try to get attention. I haven't seen too much of that. I mean, there's been, the occasional press conference, but given the devastation of the cuts, I am kind of surprised. I mean, I've talked to Trump supporters, farmers in Kansas, who are outraged. They didn't expect to have all, to lose all this funding that they depend on, and were worried about being able to, meet the next harvest. And so there's a lot of people in red states who are being impacted, and people are really upset about it.
Yeah, I think that just points to how important the work that you're doing with Capital in Maine to help just track these impacts and bring these cuts to a broader audience is just so important. One thing I wanted to ask you about as we were talking about how Doge got established is why Elon Musk? Why did Elon Musk make this his signature piece of involvement in the Trump administration, given that in many ways what Doge is doing is following the Project 2025 playbook to, really demoralize and ultimately destroy so much of the federal agencies?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question. I mean, I think part of it ties into his, there's a little bit of that ego of these tech geniuses who think that they have the answers for everything. And they look at government and they say, okay, look how government's failing and look at my business is thriving and I'm making billions. So I can go in there and fix it. And there's that thinking that the efficiency, I wrote about this in one of my first stories, even before we launched the tracker, that the efficiency regimen that you see in business in corporate America, which focuses obviously on cost cutting, but also on, management efficiencies, doesn't apply that well to the government, where you're dealing not with profits, but you're dealing with people and programs that will never turn a profit, but are necessary. And so I think just out of hubris or, ego, he kind of tackled that. And I think his own frustration probably was from dealing with the government agencies. I mean, Tesla is obviously tangled with government regulators when it comes to their safety issues. SpaceX has had issues with the FAA and with NASA regarding some of their safety record. So I think he, I don't know if it's retribution, but it's a desire to kind of go in there and have his turn to make a change to these agencies that have been sort of his nemesis for the last, 5, 10 years.
Well, he was famously wearing, I think it was that T-shirt, tech support, when he was in the in the cabinet meeting with Trump. So right. if you're just joining us, this is Your Calls Friday Media Roundtable. I'm your host, Ethan Elkind, and we're talking about the real-world impacts of DOGE, or the Department of Government Efficiency, run by Elon Musk, empowered by Donald Trump. And we're joined by Marcus Baram, who is leading the DOGE Impact Tracker, which is available on Capital and Main, a very helpful website tracker showing exactly what's happening with DOGE around the country. And our phone lines are open. If you have stories about what DOGE cuts have meant to your life, to the life of family or friends, or to the work that you're doing, we would love to hear from you. The number to call is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Or if you have concerns about what DOGE cuts might mean for everything from airline safety to workplace safety to other aspects of our lives, again, the number 866-798-TALK. And you can also email questions or comments to yourcall@kalw.org. Marcus, I wanted to focus on one of the stories coming out of Elon Musk's plans, which is to close 11 OSHA field offices. OSHA, of course, Occupational Safety and Health Administration. I think that H is for health, including one in Baton Rouge, which is the agency's only office in Louisiana. Can you talk about what's going on with OSHA and DOGE?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, it's, you know, a little bit pending. I mean, basically, they announced that they would close these field offices, which, as I write in the story, would have a huge impact in some of these areas, like in Louisiana and parts of Texas, where there are a lot of major industrial facilities, petrochemical facilities. Louisiana, I think, was considered the sixth most dangerous state for a worker in terms of accidents and fatalities. You know, they call it Cancer Alley, that section of the Mississippi. It's about 80 miles that runs down to New Orleans, that is just dotted with petrochemical facilities, all kinds of explosions and accidents that happen. Just 2 weeks after they announced the closings, there was a fatality of a worker at who's a forklift driver, and still not clear what exactly happened. So OSHA right now seems to be in its own way pushing back, because the field office is still open. And OSHA, I think, is kind of resisting. Some people at OSHA are resisting the closure, but it still is in the works. I mean, it's pending to close the office in Baton Rouge, I think one in Texas, and obviously nine others across the country. And in those areas where there's very little state regulation of worker and safety issues, it can really be devastating, because you're not going to have any watchdogs or any enforcement of, workplace safety rules if you don't have an OSHA presence. And if you make OSHA workers have to travel long distances, they won't be very much enforcement or investigation of accidents that happened at a lot of these sites.
Yeah, so much at stake. And I completely agree, for these states that don't have that sort of backstop federal or state level regulation and workplace safety standards. We did get a caller, an off-air caller, who asked about the URL for the DOGE tracker. I do want to let listeners know, if you want to see this DOGE Impact Tracker, we do have it linked on our website, Your Call, if you go to kalw.org. And you can also get it on the capitalandmain.com website. So you could Google it there. We also got an email in from Stephen, who writes, "With the stopping of medical treatment in Africa and other parts of the world, it has laid the groundwork for the spread of plagues. Why haven't our representatives and newspapers realized the impending disaster?" So, Marcus, what are your thoughts in response to those DOGE cuts, particularly their impact on public health, things like the spread of infectious diseases?
Oh, no, totally. I mean, it is shocking that there hasn't been more public outrage or, you know, political pushback on this, because it does. I mean, it's one thing when you have, you know, a food bank losing its funding, and that's terrible, obviously, for those hungry people in that community. But these are impacts that'll be felt in 5-10 years. Or sooner, where you're going to have, you know, lots of important research being done into viruses, and obviously measles all of a sudden is back in the news, you know, things that we thought we'd conquered. and they could come back. And obviously, they spread very fast. And there's a potential for untold disasters and tragedies, not only in the U.S., but obviously, as the that person mentioned, overseas,
All around the world.
in
Absolutely.
Africa. I mean, that's one thing that's kind of struck me is that there hasn't been. It's so shocking, the fact that with the closing of USAID. I mean, one thing I kept saying afterwards is that nobody, and this is, I live in Brooklyn. It's a pretty, informed community. No one knew that the number one recipient of funding from USAID was Catholic Relief Services, not exactly a woke organization. And they're the ones who were in Africa and in Asia and Southeast Asia, like doing that work, feeding people and providing vaccinations and medication. And it's incredible. The impacts of this will be felt for many years.
Well, and again, just really highlights the importance of the work that you're doing to track this. We do have a caller, Dion in Oakland, dialing in. Dion, welcome to your call.
Diane is my name.
Oh, Dion, I'm sorry. My apologies.
I want to know where all the money that is quote unquote being saved is going. Is it going to government contracts like to Elon Musk? Is that why he's so gung-ho on quote saving money? Or where is it going?
All right, thank you for that question, Marcus. Your response.
Yeah, it's a good question, Diane. Thank you. I mean, I think it's not really clear where it's going. I mean, in essence, I think a lot of it is being used for the to kind of build a reserve for the upcoming tax cuts. The number one agenda for the Trump administration has been, even beyond tariffs, I think, has been these tax cuts, which I know people in Wall Street and in the financial world have talked about for years, that they want the massive tax cuts from 2017 that expire at the end of 2025, they want them to be extended, and maybe even new tax cuts for the wealthy to be added. The cost of that is going to be hundreds of billions, if not trillions. And it's very neat, the math, when you look at it, how much they promise to save via DOGE and what the accountants say is going to be lost from these massive tax cuts for the wealthy. And so they're hoping that the DOGE cuts, I think, will, take care, equal out to the effect of the tax cuts for the wealthy.
So, Marcus, yeah, I think I really appreciate you explaining sort of what the larger purpose of the Doge cuts might be, although I'm sure there's some other goals there too by Doge backers, including just basically limiting the scope of government as well as laying the groundwork for these tax cuts. But I'm wondering, how are you keeping track of what Doge is doing? I mean, there's so many little threads here to follow. How do you get the information that is able to feed into the tracker?
It's not hard to find, I mean, to be honest. I mean, number one, obviously, I could just kind of Google and look for hits you get from whether it's a local newspaper or a national outlet or local blogs. And obviously, we call up to verify those kinds of accounts. Two, I find things on Facebook where somebody mentions a local article that maybe isn't online or is hard to find or behind a paywall. And I'm starting to get emails from readers and people, or just other people I'm talking to, people at the CFPB, for example, or people who worked at NIH who will tell me about cuts that may not have made headlines, but that they think I should know about. So it really is a variety of sources, but I obviously welcome as much as possible people out there, listeners who have heard about what's happening, have been impacted themselves, had their families and friends impacted. I welcome as much of that as possible. Just if you email me, Marcus Baram at Capital in Maine.
All right. Well, and we'll keep that information on our website as well, because we definitely want to make sure we can support, listener-supported journalism there in a real sense, if they can bring those stories to you. And we did get that question about what the dollars are going to be used for, but do you have any sense about the larger agenda? Is it just about the tax cuts, or did you want to comment on what you think might be at issue here, what the larger aims are of DOGE and Project 2025?
I mean, it is a combination. I mean, you hinted at that. Like, obviously, they want to shrink the size of government. That's long been a sort of conservative goal. going back to Reagan and before then. And I think that they see now this amazing opportunity, since they, you know, control Congress and the White House, to follow through. And obviously part of 2025 was a big part of that, to really decimate big parts of the government, especially social services, other programs that they see as, you know, too much government interference. Obviously, they go after what they consider woke little agendas, although that doesn't really save much money in the big picture. And I think, you know, obviously cutting to pay for the tax cuts, I think more conservative economists and kind of smarter people maybe in the administration kind of realize that the tax cuts will be not very welcomed and create a lot of opposition if it's seen as, you know, boosting the deficit, which is what it will do. So DOGE is sort of a way to put out there in a very cynical way, I think, oh, look at all the money we're saving and there's so much waste. And this focus on waste is, again, something that is infuriating when you see the stories about DOGE, even on mainstream news networks, where they talk about waste and fraud, because there is waste and fraud, of course, in government, like everywhere, any big company, any big organization. But they're also, they have tons of audits. There's inspectors general, who obviously Trump fired in one of his first weeks. And they're there, they're, you know, constantly scrutinizing the numbers and counting them and making sure everything is up to par. So there is fraud and waste, but there's already a whole mechanism built in to prevent that. But that's going to become another way of advancing this conservative agenda, I think, of shrinking government down to the most basic levels and just to only push things that they support, like the military. Like the Pentagon obviously has avoided a lot of DOGE cuts. I mean, anybody who knows government says, oh, you want to save $1 trillion? Look at the Pentagon. There's all kinds of programs in there that cost literally hundreds of billions of dollars that people know are wasteful.
But we haven't seen that same DOGE attack on defense. We're almost out of time here, Marcus. So just my last question for you, just if you could answer briefly, is just what else are you working on and what is next for this DOGE impact tracker?
What I'm working on now is kind of a look at things happening, some impacts happening in South Texas. South Texas is sort of where Elon Musk moved to. We call it Elon Musk's backyard, essentially, where SpaceX actually just incorporated as a company town in Southeast Texas, and kind of looking at the impacts on a number of levels, healthcare, veterans' access to healthcare, food banks in that region. That's my next story that'll probably be published next week. All right. And then for the impact tracker, we're just going to keep, you know, going at it, posting one or two or three new reports every day, and hopefully partner with some other organizations that are also focusing on this, and it, you know, create a map and create videos and promote this as much as possible.
Well, really appreciate your work to highlight these stories and to talk about it here on Your Calls Media Roundtable. Marcus Baram, leading the DOGE Impact Tracker, covering income inequality and the influence of the oil and gas industry for capital in Maine. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Ethan, thank you so much for having me on. Really appreciate it.
Absolutely. We'll have to have you back to talk about your follow-up work here.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely love to.
And next, we're going to be turning to an explosive new investigation by the New York Times revealing how the Trump family's business empire is making huge profits for both the family and for Donald Trump himself. That's coming up on Your Calls Media Roundtable. So stay with us. We'll be back just after this short break. Welcome back. For those of you joining us just now, I'm Ethan Elkind, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. We are podcasting our show. You can find out more information on our website via kalw.org. If you have a show idea for us, you can drop us a line at yourcall@kalw.org or call us. We're at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. And now we're going to turn to an explosive new investigation by the New York Times that reveals how the Trump family's business empire is making significant profits, both for the family and for Donald Trump himself. And at the center of this multi-billion dollar business empire is World Liberty, which is the family's global cryptocurrency enterprise. And a New York Times examination of World Liberty's rapid ascent from fledgling startup to international force and Mr. Trump's conversion from a crypto skeptic to now an industry cheerleader really highlights the range of conflicts of interest that have been trailing the company and the president himself. So to help us unpack Donald Trump's cryptocurrency businesses, the potential conflicts of interest, and how the president is personally profiting off of all this, we're very pleased to be joined by Eric Lipton. Eric is a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter for The New York Times. His work spans a wide range of topics from Pentagon spending to environmental regulations, and most recently, this in-depth investigation into Trump's emerging crypto empire. Thank you so much for joining us, Eric.
Thanks for having me.
And we, could, of course, could have spent a whole hour on this topic, but so we're just going to try to get through some of the key findings from your investigation that you and your colleagues at The New York Times were able to put together. So first of all, let's start with just how did Donald Trump come to embrace the world of cryptocurrency? And as you report in your articles, he had spent years deriding crypto as a haven for drug dealers and scammers. So what changed and when did that change?
It really was a kind of a series of events that happened starting during his reelection effort for his second term. And first, to some extent, you could look back at the attack on the Capitol in 2021 when he was challenging the election results falsely. And he after that happened, there was a number of major financial institutions that turned away from the Trump family and stopped doing business with them. There were real estate companies, banks, accounting firms, law firms. And this was a kind of a striking moment for the Trump family. They were, you know, effectively debanked, although they continued to able to get financing. And so that led the two sons, Don Jr. and Eric Trump, to kind of think about, well, what's it like to be not have access to the traditional financial sources of capital. And that's a complaint that a number of folks in the crypto industry have raised in the past. And so that they started to develop some affinity towards cryptocurrency because there's people in that space who think that it's an alternative to the financial sector and traditional banks. In addition, as President Trump was running, or you know, the former President Trump then was running for re-election, he observed, and he's quite an astute observer of the political environment, that there was a lot of money to be made from the cryptocurrency industry. In terms of campaign contributions. And there was a lot of folks who were very angry at the Biden administration over the aggressive enforcement policy that came from the Securities and Exchange Commission. And so Trump began to court those folks and began to collect millions and millions of dollars in campaign contributions, not only from the venture capitalists that were backing the companies and from the crypto companies themselves, but also from the community of crypto owners who kind of represented a decent constituency that potentially he could bring on as voters. So by the time the election comes around, Trump has promised to make the United States into the crypto capital of the world. He's also promised to potentially pardon the guy that was in charge, that ran the Silk Road effort that had been convicted of crimes in the United States, and he was becoming a champion and a kind of a savior for the crypto industry as he comes into office. And it's just as he's coming into office that his sons open the doors at World Liberty Financial.
Well, it's pretty interesting that after January 6th, as you noted, he seemed to lack access to some of these traditional financing mechanisms. So I'm wondering how much his personal economic circumstances then played into it. Is there evidence that his real estate business, for example, was suffering after January 6th, especially, and also knowing that he's been hit with some very major civil suit judgments for sexual harassment, sexual abuse. Did that play into his embracing cryptocurrency?
And there's no question that during the pandemic and then in the aftermath, of January 6th, that the growth potential for the traditional real estate piece of the Trump organization's kind of portfolio was curbed. And we saw this even during his first term when they tried to open a couple new hotel brands in the United States that never were able to get off the ground. And they lost a bunch of their hotels in different places around the world that were Trump branded in places like Panama and Hawaii and a couple places in Canada, that they were essentially taking down the Trump brand name, and that meant the end of fees and other payments to the Trump family. But at the same time, you know, the Trump family had launched Truth Social and Trump, you know, Trump Media, that at least on paper represented the single biggest asset for President Trump. And although, you know, it's a publicly traded company, he owns a large share of that stock. And so that's the biggest source of his wealth. And now that company itself is an enormous money loser. It's not generated any profit, and its future is really sort of up in the air. Although he is quite wealthy just from the value of the stock itself. Although if he were to sell it, that would crash the stock price. But crypto definitely is a growth area for them. And I've spoken with Eric Trump about this, and he's incredibly enthusiastic about the potential future profits that they can generate from crypto. And so I do think that they see this as an alternative way for them to make money. And the dad being president has only made that, you know, it's going to make it more lucrative for them.
Well, let's talk about some of the sort of structural mechanisms that for them to be able to take advantage of this potential wealth from crypto. Can you talk about World Liberty and how World Liberty Financial, which is largely owned by a Trump family corporate entity registered in Delaware, how that is structured and how that plays into their ability to make money off of crypto?
So World Liberty effectively is born in October, just before the election. It initially begins to sell governance tokens, which allow you to have a say in some of the kind of the strategic decisions that the entity is making, although initially you couldn't sell those tokens once you bought them. But when they first put them on sale in October, it was a total flop. There were very few buyers. And, you know, they had a goal of selling $300 million worth of that governance token, and they only sold, you know, tens of millions of dollars. But so then Trump gets elected, and he's on his way to becoming inaugurated. And next thing you know, there are hundreds of millions of dollars of tokens that are selling. And among the buyers is a native of China who is a Asia-based crypto trader and executive named Justin Sun, whose company Tron had been targeted by the Securities and Exchange Commission for violating federal securities laws, and there was a pending lawsuit in the United States federal court around that. And Justin Sun becomes one of the biggest buyers of World Liberty after Trump is reelected, and eventually, you know, buys up at least $75 million worth of the tokens. And then Trump, of course, gets inaugurated, and next thing you know, there's a move by the Department of Justice to enter into court and announce and ask the judge in that case to suspend the docket, because the Justin Sun and Tron and the Justice Department are negotiating a settlement of that matter. So now, you know, do we know that there was a quid pro quo where I'll give you $75 million and you'll kill my pending SEC investigation? No, we don't. And of course, you know, the World Liberty says that there was no such agreement, but that temporally that there was that event effect. And similarly, there's a guy named Arthur Hayes from BitMEX, which was one of a big crypto company. And Arthur Hayes was sentenced to 6 months of home confinement after he had federal law violations relative to trading on his platform, which United States residents were not supposed to be trading on. And he was pardoned by President Trump after one of his affiliates partnered with World Liberty Financial. So you have a guy that gets a pardon, you have a guy whose SEC case got stopped. I mean, those are just a couple, and I could go on, unfortunately, for about 30 minutes. Huh. There have been so many of these just truly just extraordinary scandal level conflicts of interest associated with World Liberty, that that's what we detailed in this pretty extensive 4,000 word story, which is even a long story for the New York Times. We just tried to document as many of these conflicts as we could. And it was the breadth of them was just breathtaking. In fact,
yeah. It's truly remarkable how, you know, really almost any of these examples, you know, would have been a major scandal. And yet in our current political environment with Republicans in control of Congress, it just seems like there's really been no oversight or follow-up at this point, although I do want to get to that potential in a bit. But first, I just want to let listeners know that this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. I'm Ethan Elkind, and we're talking about the Trump family's involvement in cryptocurrency, all of the conflicts of interest as they have been making money in the crypto world while potentially using their ability to manipulate enforcement to help enrich themselves. We are joined by Eric Lipton, Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter for the New York Times, who has covered this story with an in-depth investigation into Trump's emerging crypto empire. And the phone lines are open if you have questions for Eric about how Trump has been profiting off of crypto, about what should be done to try to hold some of these conflicts to account, to bring more transparency to what is happening here. The number to call to join this conversation is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255, or email any questions or comments you have to yourcall@kalw.org. Well, Eric, one question I have just about the logistics of how they're making money here. How is it that they are profiting off of the crypto? If they're, are they making profits from the companies themselves? Are they trying to hold on until they can sell at a profit? Or are there other mechanisms that they're making money off of crypto? Can you walk us through that?
Yeah, there's a few. And again, unfortunately, quite complicated, but I'll try to do it quite simply. So the biggest single source of revenue so far that they're going to see comes from the government of the United Arab Emirates, which is, again, an incredibly outrageous and scandalous level event, would be kind of historic in it alone as this act. But about 2 weeks ago now, there was World Liberties, one of their executives, Zach Witkoff, the son of the Middle East advisor to the president, Steve Witkoff, another, you know, major, you know, conflict there, the son of the Middle East, has announced that the government of the United Arab Emirates, through one of its subsidiaries, was going to put $2 billion worth of investment into World Liberty Financial in the form of what's called the stable coin, which is a form of cryptocurrency that maintains a stable dollar-to-dollar value no matter what's happening in the crypto market, which is very volatile. And the way that they're going to make money off of that is that the way that the stable coins work is that World Liberty takes that $2 billion and it buys short-term treasury bonds and other, and it takes the yield, the 3% or 4%, depending on the interest rates, and it keeps the yield. So $2 billion of stablecoin revenue going into the bank, if you do the math on that, you know, that's tens of millions of dollars already of yield that single investment presents alone. And the way that the small fine print on the World Liberty's website says is that the Trump family and its partners are entitled to the bulk of the net revenues after expenses are deducted from World Liberty. So that already represents tens of millions of dollars likely over time that's going to go to the Trump family and its partners, effectively from the government of the United Arab Emirates. And Trump next week is on his way to UAE and Saudi Arabia and Qatar. And so that's just a single source of revenue. I mean, similarly, when Justin Sun put $75 million by buying the governance token, the Trump family is supposed to get most of the net revenues from purchases of the governance token after the costs associated with running it are cleared. So, I mean, those are a couple of ways. I mean, you know, the most worrisome thing is that there's a foreign government the $2 billion went into World Liberty so that they could invest money in Binance, which is the world's largest cryptocurrency platform. But in several of the securities, you know, lawyers and security executives that I spoke with said, well, it wasn't necessary at all for this sovereign wealth fund from Abu Dhabi to put money into stablecoin through World Liberty to get the Binance. They could have gone directly to Binance. So why did they go to World Liberty other than for some reason to want to impress Trump and his family? But those are a couple of ways that they're making money, but it's clear that it is a lot of money. And again, when I saw Eric Trump recently at Trump Doral, where the Saudi-backed LIV Golf tournament was being held last month in April, and I ran into Eric Trump and asked him about how things are going with World Liberty, he said to me that it's one of the most successful ventures they've ever created in terms of return on investment.
And you've touched on this a little bit, but just how they're potentially using the powers of government action, Department of Justice, et cetera, to essentially take the heat off of any bad actors in the crypto space. Can you talk about what's been going on with enforcement by the SEC, the Securities and Exchange Commission, and how that has changed from what the Biden administration's approach to crypto was to what we're seeing now with the Trump administration?
I mean, it couldn't be more night and day. Biden's people, Gary Gensler, who was the head of the SEC during Biden's tenure, was incredibly aggressive and effectively felt that most token issuances should be registered as securities. And there were more. There were nearly 100 different litigations initiated during Gensler's tenure, including almost all of the major crypto platforms, not only that do business in the United States, but even Binance, because the allegation was that it was illegally handling transactions for U.S.-based citizens that weren't allowed to be trading on its non-U.S. platform. And so Gensler had the most aggressive, by far, historic enforcement effort against crypto. He was hated by the crypto industry, hated so much, in fact, that some crypto executives said that any law firm that hired one of his former lawyers from the SEC that these crypto companies were going to drop them as law firms as a form of punishment. And so Trump, you know, in accepting millions of dollars from the crypto industry, promised to basically, you know, roll back that. And when he appointed the acting chair of the SEC, even before his permanent chair, Paul Atkins, was confirmed, the acting chair not only did he announce that they were largely shutting down their crypto enforcement unit, or at least reducing its staff and curtailing it and saying that it would no longer focus on potential securities violation issues, but the Department of Justice also announced that it was shutting down its own crypto enforcement unit. And many of the cases, more than a dozen different cases, including Justin Sun's case at Tron, were either terminated or have been frozen. So the United States is now basically out of the business of enforcing crypto law and trying to examine whether or not various crypto activities represent, you know, unregistered securities, mm-hmm. which are not properly informing the public of, you know, not making all these transactions as transparent as they should be. So, mm-hmm. That correlates with the rise of world liberty, and world liberty is benefiting from that rollback of regulatory enforcement.
It just feels like a classic corruption situation as we're going to the Wild West here with crypto. We just have a few minutes left, so I want to talk about what's being done in response. Now, first of all, there is a bill pending in Congress, the so-called Genius Act. And can you talk about what that bill is and how it might be helping the crypto industry?
So this Genius Act would create the first regulatory structure by Congress. It's a huge deal for the crypto industry, because right now crypto is regulated under, you know, decades-old securities laws that were built for, you know, stocks really and traditional investments, not for crypto. So the Genius Act, which was embraced by both Dems and Republicans, was just yesterday facing what's called a cloture vote, which would have allowed it to move to final action by the Senate. And a bunch of the Democrats who had previously endorsed it before the Senate Banking Committee, when it came through committee, changed their votes and voted against cloture. And a couple of things were happening. Some of them said they were unsatisfied with anti-money laundering provisions. But in fact, there's also a growing disgust at what the Trump family is doing. And World Liberty is issuing its own stablecoin. So the president would be signing legislation that would be benefiting his company. Because while it is regulation around stablecoins, what it really does is it legitimizes the stablecoin industry. And once that law is passed, then stablecoins will become a part of American commerce in a way that you've never seen before. They're going to become competition to banks, and there will be enormous growth once that legislation is passed. So that legislation has now been stalled, and in fact, it's in part due to our reporting because of what we've disclosed around the kind of conflicts of interest relating to World Liberty Financial. We were actually cited by a couple of senators in a caucus mm-hmm. meeting, and our coverage is why it was important for the Democrats to reconsider their position on it, and they did. And now that bill is stalled.
Well, it's a great example of the impact that reporting can have, and we're very pleased to be able to highlight it here on our media roundtable. Again, we're just running out of time here. I just want to ask you, if the federal government, if the Trump administration is not going to be enforcing crypto, you know, laws and protections for the public, and Congress isn't going to do anything, at least under the Republicans, who's going to fill that gap? Where could there possibly be an enforcement and accountability?
I mean, it's tough. I mean, I guess the state attorneys general do have some, New York State has its own crypto enforcement efforts, and they have separately done litigation, for example, around Tether is one company, and also I'm just thinking that that's at least one, but they've had a pretty aggressive crypto enforcement because they have a crypto registration requirement. And so certain states could choose to, although most states don't really have the resources legally to do it. Honestly, it's reporters. The inspectors general of most of these agencies have been fired. The head of the Office of Government Ethics was fired. The head of the Office of Special Counsel was fired. The Department of Justice has shut down, its investigative units. So there really is, that's one of the things that Trump has done is he has basically terminated almost all accountability. And the Republicans who have subpoena power do not intend to use it to investigate any of these matters. So there's very little ability to have accountability in the United States right now, other than the kind of work that we're doing and other reporters are doing.
Well, I'm glad you're doing it. And just last question for you, what else are you working on? What are you following now that we can look forward to reading about?
We're going to continue to follow issues around cryptocurrency and around conflicts of interest relating to the Trump family and their real estate ventures and other ventures. It's just, there's so many of them. There was a story that published on Monday that I wrote about Donald Trump Jr., who was traveling in Serbia and Bulgaria and Romania and giving paid speeches. And in Serbia, there's a hotel project that's slated to be built on government, that's land that's owned by the government of Serbia. He had dinner with the president of Serbia who grilled a pig for Don Jr., as they were talking about the hotel project. At the same time, Eric was in Qatar and in Dubai talking about real estate and crypto projects. And back in Washington, D.C., they were launching something called the Executive Branch, which is going to be a new private club at $500,000 a person that Don Jr. is a part owner of, that's going to be lobbyists and government officials and the Trump family and crypto executives all in one place at a private club. And so it's sort of like a Mar-a-Lago. It's target rich and it's keeping us very busy. I hope that people will read these stories. It's important that people engage with them and that they read them and that they share them, because if you don't read or share them or contemplate them, then there is no accountability. Yeah. Then this all goes into a vacuum. So it's just important that people don't turn away. You need to be aware of it.
No, thank you so much, Eric Lipton, Pulitzer Prize winning investigative reporter for the New York Times. I think that was very well said. And thank you for your work and for coming on Your Calls Media Roundtable.